Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled Urban Planning in Malta. This talk is delivered by Dr. Antoine Zamit.
Before I commence my lecture, I would like to first of all thank the Malta Historical Society. Particular thanks also to Dr. Manuel Buttigieg, who has helped me out throughout in preparation for this lecture, and the Palazzo Falzon, particularly Francesca Balsan, for all the logistics. I would also like to thank my head of department, Dr. Paul Gauci, who unfortunately couldn't make it tonight, who has been very kind in sharing his insights into urban planning in Malta, as well as his research on the subject. So here goes. This is Malta, Mediterranean sun, beach, sea, history, tradition. This is how we project it. This is how we sell it beyond our shores. This is our safety catch, and this is our consolation. There is safety in reliance on a rich and culturally diverse history. There is consolation in having inherited this legacy. But accepting a legacy also means accepting the darker side of things. Malta is also this: speculative, clientelistic, and possibly corrupt. It is an island wherein deep-rooted patron-client relationships have been the order of the day, whether formally or informally. A population that has historically been powerless and dependent on a ruling body for centuries and that has almost developed an inherent DNA of subservience, time and time again allowing paternalistic governments to steam ahead with decisions in a top-down fashion. The island is today still characterized by the leading presence of the central state, a corresponding weak level of local governance, and a non-existing regional tier. This is a short story of a once proud urban fabric left for many decades to the mercy of the speculator. It is also a story of a young 21-year-old and largely reactive planning system, which has done little to prevent or preempt such developments from taking place, and which to date has focused on issues of land use and construction, to the detriment of urban design quality and sustainable urbanism. This is evidenced by the spirit and remit of the main policy documents approved since the authority's inception, as well as the attitude adopted by many of the stakeholders involved throughout the planning process. Thirdly, and very importantly for this discussion, it is a story of a nation that, to date, has not formally recognized planning as a distinct profession. All this is Malta, wherein the above phenomena happen via complex and multi-way relationships that must be understood, or at the very least taken into account, in order to fully appreciate where we are at today. These relationships are amplified by the island's insularity, its government traditions, and its relatively recent independence. These forces may have a big bearing on why planning developed the way it did, and how it is now, as Malta simultaneously struggles to catch up with current wider global phenomena and reflect them in practice through the new governance structures. Now, when looking at the development of urban planning in Malta, or wherever in that respect, one cannot disassociate the social history of a population from its physical history. And it is often through the former that one may conclude certain aspects in relation to the latter. As a practitioner, my interest lies in the connections between the legacy of our urban settlements today and the rationale behind their establishment. In my view, such a discussion allows us to contextualize the exercise of planning today. Let us first look at the legacy of urban settlements that may be found around us. In turn, this will help us analyze how the urban conurbation, which I shall define as the most discernible extent of urban development, has grown to what it is today. In 1994, Beely and Charlton carried out an analysis of the Maltese urban environment. In their view, Malta could be broadly characterized by four settlement typologies: the older traditional settlements, the fortified planned historic settlements, the 19th century Victorian schemes, and the recent settlements. So basing ourselves on this work, we may proceed to evaluate what each subdivision comprises. We have much to learn from the early settlements, as informal as they could have been. These settlements were based on simple principles that responded to nature. Issues in relation to terrain, topography, location, orientation, positioning, and proximity to natural resources, such as the availability of natural water springs and arable land, dictated the location of caves in the case of the troglodytes, and the first built forms and planimetric decision-making that ensued. By following the natural contours of the land, and that translated into the irregular street pattern which we have become so accustomed to today. The residential patterns per se were most probably directly related to the agricultural activity that was carried out. These were hamlets, small, dispersed settlements in the open countryside that in time continued developing gradually outwards in proximity to the land being managed. In addition to these hamlets, the organic citadel of Mdina, or the Civitas, was established as the political and administrative enclave of the island of Malta, on the highest terrain. The sparse population was concentrated within the citadel, together with the citadel of Gozo and the small village of Il Borgo, or Burgo. These patterns started to change with the advent of the Arabs in Malta, most probably due to a diversified economy, namely cotton production, which in turn dictated settlement pattern shifts towards larger inland villages. Fast forward to the 15th century, where documentary evidence recording the distribution of villages in Malta, from studies carried out by Whittinger, illustrates that the majority of the population lived in the outskirts of the Mdina citadel, in Rabat, and the surrounding localities, creating, therefore, the island's first urban conurbation. After the building of Valletta, which we shall briefly look at next, these towns and villages underwent some significant redevelopment in the 17th and 18th centuries, leading to the rebuilding of parishes into grander Baroque churches, which became new focal points dominating the settlement skylines. Well, until a few years ago, that is. Mdina also underwent a radical transformation after the damage it sustained in the 1693 earthquake, through Lorenzo Caffaro's new cathedral, but also through the enlargement of the previously medieval space into a much larger and formalized new square. Many scholars, and I am sure many of you present here, would agree that the turning point in urban planning in Malta was the planning of Valletta. Not only because of its design and gridiron disposition, which I shall not dwell upon, but also due to two other important aspects. First, the building regulations drawn up by the Orders Commission, known as the Ufficio delle Case, in 1569, and second, due to the spatial implications that the building of the capital city had on urban settlements. Most of the building regulations could be considered as urban design control, as well as being justifiable from a military point of view. One such regulation was the prohibition of front gardens, which ensured that a consistent building line was kept. Those who precluded a potential enemy from hiding within the recesses formed otherwise by such setback. Other requirements were aesthetic, such as the requirement to embellish corner buildings, or functional, such as the need for a cistern dug in the rock to be filled by rainwater collected from the roof, with obviously important military implications in times of water scarcity. But the emphasis was on the street as much as it was on the building. It was about the relationship between the building and the street, the urban space, the public realm, in sharp contrast with today, where, frankly, the street has been entirely relegated. In Billy and Charlton's words, the building of the new capital and the expansion of the settlements around the Grand Harbour marked the beginning of an urban sprawl, which grew to become Malta's new urban conurbation, an outward-looking system based on Valletta and the harbours. The schemes dating from the British occupation continued forming settlements around the harbours. Indeed, during the British rule, Malta experienced yet another dramatic transformation in its conurbation, as about two-thirds of the population came to reside in the urban and suburban settlements adjacent to the harbours, further reinforcing the conurbation established in the time of the Knights of St. John. Effectively, the roots of our planning system, and of Maltese planning as we know it, lie in the 1880 Sanitary Ordinance, itself a refinement of the Code of Police Laws, instituted in 1854, which constituted 23 chapters on specific subjects, including prescriptive standards in relation to both streets and dwellings. The public health standards established by this ordinance had a substantial effect on streetscapes and townscape, with the requirements for a minimum street width of 20 feet, a building height to street width ratio that was not to exceed 2:1, and the introduction of a backyard having a minimum depth of 10 feet running along the entire plot width. In De Luca's words, these rectangular plots soon led to the emergence of more regular streetscapes, more in line with the row houses of England than the traditional vernacular idiom of the older village quarters. In 1935, an aesthetics building ordinance established an aesthetics board, having 4 to 10 members by ministerial appointment, that was empowered to control issues of building symmetry, provide guidelines for the design of facades, and ensure good civic design in terms of preservation of amenity. The design of any construction or alteration to a facade of a building that was visible from a street had to be submitted through a warranted perit to this board. The board's functions ceased with the establishment of the planning authority, but there have been recent calls by the Camerat al Periti, that is the local chamber of architects and civil engineers, for the establishment of design review panels in order to address the design quality deficit that we face. This is a proposal that has been endorsed by central government in its recent National Environment Plan, with a view of commencing such reviews in the very near future. On to the recent settlements. The recent settlements are those settlements built after the war and may be further subdivided into 5 typologies. The first, post-war reconstructions. In the post-war period, government's main priority naturally revolved around reconstruction. And in 1943, the British architects Harrison and Hubbard were called in to put forward their plan for Valletta and the Three Cities. The second typology of recent settlements is the new residential areas derived from the home ownership schemes and the building development area schemes, which I will discuss soon. There was further urban growth into suburbs, formed either as peripheral outgrowths or as distinct urban-suburban conglomerates, some of which were planned, whereas others grew haphazardly, without any adherence to any plan. The fourth typology was tourist-oriented residential development in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, that further established distinct areas with higher height limitations. And fifthly, the more recently redeveloped urban fringes, due to the recent policies allowing the development of apartment block typologies. These settlements resulted in a larger urban conurbation that spread even further outwards, localities growing and fusing into one another, and forming the urban mass, the urban conurbation that we have today, wherein the Grand Harbour has extended into a large portion of central Malta, forming a continuous urban fabric. In 1530, 10% of the population could be classified as town dwellers. By 1798, 50% of the population lived in the Grand Harbour conurbation. In 2007, 94% of the population lived in urban areas. The post-war building boom and rampant development between the 60s and the 80s, I'm going to discuss this next, expanded the inner core outwards and established newly planned areas incorporating a road hierarchy and sizable residential plots. This boom contributed to more than a fourfold increase in the built-up area of the Maltese Islands. So planning in the 20th century. After the war, the interim measure until an eventual planning law was to be enacted was the establishment of a building control board, established in 1945 and chaired by the Director of Public Works. At this time, the Maltese planning system was based on key plans that schematically simply indicated external boundaries. Since they were not exhaustive, this gave way to ad hoc decision making in response to development demands, allocating serviceable land as the need arose. Jeffrey Switzer, a consultant appointed by the Commonwealth in order to help with planning in Malta, had harsh words with how planning was being performed in Malta. In a damning report, he criticized the piecemeal key plan system in existence, and more notably, the building control board's disregard of such plans when making decisions. Switzer further alleged that corrupt practices in Malta existed by having a building control board that had absolute powers and due to the absence of published planning schemes. He proposed, therefore, making the islands a planning area. This meant two things: that the key plan system would be abolished and that the countryside was to be within the domain of the planning system. His recommendations led to the enactment of a new ordinance in 1962 that revoked the 1945 building control regulations. The ordinance empowered government to declare Malta as a planning area, or any part of Malta in actual fact. Government subsequently established the Planning Area Permits Board, the PAPB, to implement the regulations. Interestingly, or rather tragically, the PAPB was, however, operating without the presence of any policy framework. Hence, the start of a series of efforts and the involvement of a number of foreign consultants aimed at developing a plan for Malta. All these consultants prepared reports that, in the words of Gauci, concluded in a similar manner: that there was no effective land management, that there was an accelerated rate of physical development, and that the setting up of the PAPB in the absence of a clear policy framework meant that physical development was taking place on the basis of seemingly arbitrary decision making. In the meantime, in 1965, Italconsult, an Italian firm brought over through the United Nations Development Programme, started work on an outline physical plan, development plan for Malta. A year later, another United Nations team, led this time by Patterson, 1966, was to prepare the National Development Plan. On Patterson's advice, Sir Desmond Heap from the UK was sent to draft the new Planning Act for Malta. Heap believed that this had to be a simplified version of the UK's 1947 Town and Country Planning Act. A new board was also set up, chaired by the Director of Public Works. This town planning board analysed other European planning systems and also considered that the best model was the British Town and Country Planning Act of 1947. Note that this was 20 years after the UK's Act. So the Act was prepared. And although it was approved in 1969, the Minister of Public Buildings and Works did not put it into practice. The 1971 and subsequent Labour administrations did not show any interest in implementing it and eventually repealed it in 1981, stating to Prime Minister Don Mintoff that its presence would have undermined the social housing efforts that had been carried out in the 12 years since its enactment. Yet another United Nations team, led this time by a Polish architect planner, Tiskowski, was to prepare a national land development plan while the Act was being discussed. This was throughout the 1967 to 1970 period. The plan, an outline development plan for Malta and another for Gozo, remained valid until the mid-80s, and although, for a change, it was not officially adopted, it was, however, referred to by the PAPB. A number of development typologies developed during this time. Significantly, government-assisted residential developments and governmental social housing developments. In line with the welfare state philosophy of the Maltese government in the 1971 to 1987 Labour administration, several housing estates were completed in the western, central and southern parts of Malta, and new communities were established which contained government-owned rented dwellings, complementing the slum clearance program undertaken by the administration. A home ownership scheme, the HOS, was launched in 1962, consisting of service plots subject to a very low ground rent. Long-term institutional finance was facilitated, and brought within the reach of income groups who would have otherwise found it virtually impossible to own their own house. The scheme's popularity increased when plots of several sizes started being offered in several localities, concentrated in the outer edges of settlements. In a few years, the home ownership schemes, with its overly sized plots, became one of the most successful means of housing provision in Malta. In 1967, further housing estates were constructed in other localities in central and southern Malta. In 1976, a housing authority was established, a semi-autonomous institution set up to ensure that the supply of housing units kept pace with demand. And by the 1980s, more than 5,000 dwelling units had been built in various towns and villages. The program of construction remained based on the extension of existing townscapes and townships. New housing schemes, the Building Development Areas, the BDA, were introduced in the 1980s through the BDA Act, the 1983 Act. The residential development built through these schemes consisted of flats and terraced dwellings, again located on the urban fringes throughout the Maltese Islands. Together with the home ownership schemes plots issued in the previous years, the BDA contributed to the rampant development of the urban fringes as we know them today. Generally located next to existing or planned HOS, the BDA literally extended the landscape of government housing further into the fringes, resulting in extensive, nondescript, badly planned urban sprawl within the peri-urban areas. The plots were largely similar in shape, and the two-story terraced housing designed for them was based on a typical module, irrespective of context and irrespective of particularity of site and location. This template architecture repeated itself within the outer areas of the different urban settlements. It was characterized by a Maltese revivalism style that was very popular at the grassroots level, and wherein motifs and decorative elements pertaining to other periods, including classical elements, were borrowed. This often created a cacophony of streetscapes, defined by Peter Hall as mimicry and pastiche. In his words, the results are bizarre. Arriving in a place that looks exactly like Westbourne Park in London or Westbourne Park in Adelaide, the visitor suddenly notices that the date above the portico is not 1859, but 1980. The building development areas were criticized because land was compulsory purchased by government and it was not always given to social causes, but for private home buyers' benefit. According to the ministers, this act was meant to erase land speculation, hence the active and direct involvement by government as an active land taker and developer. But the reality on the ground was that speculation or corrupt practices were not eliminated. Allegations of corruption heightened in the 1980s in relation to increased central government powers and direct ministerial control over the workings of the PAPB. These allegations resulted from scheme modifications and land use issues. In Gauchi's words, the Department of Works would create departmental schemes of a temporary nature, endorsed by the minister, who therefore had total control over these schemes that could change as desired. Especially between the 1976 and 1981 period, where many green areas were extended into the schemes. There was a second building boom in the late 70s, early 80s, due to apartment blocks in relation to mass tourism accommodation requirements. And countless terraced houses were built through the HOS immediately before and immediately after 1981 elections. The year 1987 marked the end of the Labour government era and the start of the Nationalist government, whose initial priority was to contain further haphazard development. For the new government, planning had to be depoliticized. In the spirit, the temporary provision schemes, the TPS, were introduced a year later to identify drop boundaries to the land that could be developed. The boundaries of the 1988 schemes were meant to close up existing development areas and, where possible, designate uncontrolled tracts along the peripheries of these areas as land allocated outside development zones. In 1990, the structure plan for the Maltese Islands was formulated, a very vague and unclear document, which is still in force today, in spite of it being outdated and, from many aspects, irrelevant. This structure plan became legally binding through the Development Planning Act, the DPA, of 1992. The Act also established the Planning Authority, which became the official legal body responsible for forward planning, development control, and enforcement for the entire country. According to Aquilina, the Act was, to a large extent, modelled on Sir Desmond Heath's Town and Country Planning Act of 1969, which, if you recall, had been modelled on the UK's 1947 Act. In spite of all the goodwill that accompanied these improvements, in the first 2 years of the Planning Authority's operation, a striking 11,770 residential units were granted planning permission, with an even more striking 65% of these units located outside existing urban areas, contributing to the establishment of what we now call the urban-suburban conglomerates. Between 1994 and 2000, almost 50% more apartments were approved in 2000 as opposed to 1994, with a resultant decrease in terraced houses. In the absence of detailed plans to guide developments, the planning system was reactive, simply responding somewhat haphazardly to development applications rather than planning for them in advance. Forward planning at the territorial scale would occur eventually through the formulation of the local plans for the different local areas, a process that, however, took over 10 years to complete. In 1997, and more recently in 2001, a number of amendments to the Development Planning Act were carried out, and new bodies independent of the Planning Authority were set up, such as the EPD, the Environment Protection Department, to safeguard the interests of the environment. In 2001, the PA and the EPD merged to become one authority, as we know it today, the Malta Environment and Planning Authority, MEPA. Now, inevitably, the long process to formulate the local plans meant that they became irrelevant from a number of aspects, and they have had to be reviewed almost immediately. Within these plans, urban conservation areas were formally designated, together with formal limits to development within individual settlements. At the building scale, the MEPA has also released specific guidance in the form of development control policy and design guidance to guide residential and other forms of development. There were two other more recent peaks in terms of the issuing of development planning permits and construction activity: pre-EU accession in 2004 and pre-Euro adoption 2008. The second peak occurred following the rationalisation of the development zone boundaries, which was carried out in 2006, supposedly intended to remove grey areas that were present within the 11,000 hectares of temporary provision schemes carried out in 1988. The rationalisation increased land provision for urban development by 2.3%, thus extending the development zone, mostly in areas bordering on the previous scheme boundary or already committed by previous development. It also transformed a number of previously designated outside development zones into developable areas. The prospect of a more open market, characterized by a higher proportion of European buyers or of buyers who would be attracted to Malta becoming an EU member state, resulted in a thriving market dominated by developers and wherein prices became unrealistically high. In this environment, many developers were not incentivized to build high-quality developments, which eventually resulted in what we have today, an oversupply of largely low-quality residential stock that now remains largely unsold. A A second controversy has arisen with the relaxation of building heights within the new local plans and the indiscriminate allowance of 3 floors plus penthouse developments, occasionally including semi-basements, replacing 2-story terrace developments. Private homeowners, therefore, became potential developers in their own right, which further resulted in the proliferation of the apartment block residential typology, both within inner areas and at development edges. This development typology has created a mass that often screens the inner workings of the villages, destroying important landmarks that historically characterized the settlement's townscape and that defined their skyline. Another planning initiative that had serious implications on the urban environment in the manner it was implemented was the floor area ratio, the FAR, throughout the 2000-2006 period, which gave developers the opportunity to achieve higher developments by offsetting the developable floor space vertically and releasing open space within the site. In principle, the FAR policy was potentially based on positive objectives. It sought to direct and incentivize development in enclaves that would stimulate further job creation and also generate much-needed open spaces within dense settlements. Nonetheless, it had a number of shortcomings. First, the FAR was not part of something more comprehensive, but it was used sporadically, irrespective of the urban fabric. In many cases, the FAR ended up being more of a quantitative exercise with regard to the building volume rather than an urban design exercise. Second, its applicability to a site was solely based on land area rather than on an urban approach that considered context. In most cases, the resulting development created through the application of this policy was out of sync with the human scale and the surrounding lower-lying developments, resulting in their overshadowing. Architecturally, blank walls resulted between newer and older developments, with no adequate buffer or transition zone generally envisaged or requested by the authority. With regard to the released open space that the FAR gave, the emphasis was on its area provision rather than on its quality or its design. There were also no proper safeguards as to the public nature of such space, with the tendency of some developments designed around internal open spaces that in time became private areas. The Office of the Prime Minister spearheaded a reform of the authority in July 2009, which passed in Parliament in 2010. As a result, the Development Planning Act was repealed in the exercise of the new Comprehensive and Inclusive Environment and Development Planning Act 2010. Malta in 2013. The past months have been characterized by a change in government, which has brought with it a change in direction with regard to the MEPA. Although the 2001 merge of the Planning Authority and the Environment Protection Department was intended as a means of addressing both planning and environmental issues more holistically, the Labour Party argued that a singular authority addressing both issues tended to favour planning priorities at the expense of the environment. As a result, these two functions shall now be split, necessitating, therefore, a reformulation of our Planning Act. In my view, this reformulation should be seen as an opportunity to enshrine design quality as a key cornerstone within this Act. The only reference to design in the current Act is to aesthetics, which is often reduced to style. Clearly, this is a very limited perspective of what constitutes good design, which is much broader in scope, encompassing the setting of sustainable targets and urban design objectives. Establishing a clear understanding of design quality within the Act would give it the significance it truly deserves in the weighing of material considerations during decision-making. And this latches on to another important discussion concerning the fundamentals of the Maltese planning system. The system requires decision makers to start with the consideration of plans and policies, but also allows for administrative discretion, allowing them, but not planning officers, to give due regard to other material considerations. If the consideration is material enough, a departure from the plans and policies is warranted, so long as it is justified. Discretion is therefore not simply policy interpretation. Discretion implies policy deviation. What this effectively means is that, unlike other European regulatory planning systems, policies are there to primarily provide guiding principles. They are not the rule of law. If they were the rule of law, decision makers would not be able to deviate from them. What appears to have happened in practice is a reversal of this, of the above. Subsequent amendments to the Planning Act and the more recent Environment and Development Planning Act of 2010 have specified that a greater regard be given to policies and development plans. In spite of these legal provisions, however, there appears to be a significant amount of uncertainty with regard to the exercise of discretion in practice. My research has confirmed that some planning officers exercise discretion, whereas others do not, creating confusion in the process, while decision makers have very rarely applied their discretion in the name of quality. There also appears to be an over-adherence to policy, accompanied by increasingly a quantitative rather than qualitative approach. In the words of the Kamrat Alperiuti, a mediocre project which meets set parameters may be speedily approved. Innovative solutions that cannot readily be categorized into standards often encounter insurmountable hurdles, the result of a system which fears innovation, favoring instead the reproduction of basic stereotypes. The system has further been overloaded with a plethora of policies that fail to consider the most important urban scale, the streets. Again, my recent research clearly reveals a missing scale in policymaking. The majority of policies oscillate between broad planning and specific architectural considerations, rather than focusing on the streetscape. In addition, the policies are largely quantitative. They lack a three-dimensional approach, and they tend to be either vaguely defined, as in the case of the local plans, or prescriptive and restrictive in nature, as in the case of the building-specific policies. A number of socio-cultural undercurrents are present within our multi-society, and these have become ingrained in everyday life. These may also be found in other southern European and Mediterranean countries, and they are further the result of the island's relatively recent independence, as well as the insularity that characterizes it. Acknowledging their presence is important in order to understand the context wherein planning endeavors were made in the 60s and the 70s, and the particular course that planning took post-independence. In this respect, 1984 research by Zammit argues that multi-society adapted to the colonial presence in a number of ways, among which was individual manipulation through patronage, characterized by personal patron-client relationships, wherein favors are granted in return for political support. He contends that the roots of patronage in Malta may be traced to the fact that the island was a colony, or client state, which resulted in a significant dependence on Britain for all available economic and employment opportunities. But patron-client relationships are not phenomena of the 20th century. In the Civitas of Indina, building-related decisions were taken by the Universitas, under the direct control over the town ruler, who was a very powerful individual and who, in Dali's words, established strong networks of patron-client relationships to monopolize the available resources. Equally, in the time of the Order of St. John, the Officio della Casa was under the direct control of the Grand Master. Under the British, the Universitas was replaced by the Board of Supply that was also a government-appointed entity. Fast forward to the post-independence period, and planning was the direct remit of the Minister for Public Works. In turn, the need for economic survival in post-colonial Malta has also been characterized by a societal culture of safeguarding primarily personal and familiar interests before national ones. So when seen in the light of this tradition of paternalistic governance and these social cultural attitudes, the decision to found an autonomous planning authority in 1992 suddenly obtains a heightened dimension. For this decision was not only a reaction to the 1960s and to 1980s period, but it actually sought to break a mold that has much deeper roots. At the same time, in spite of the turnaround that the 1992 Development Planning Act and the setting up of the Planning Authority brought about, Chapman and Kossar have argued that the results on the ground still fall short of what is now intended. Again, they attribute this partly to socio-cultural factors, wherein the newly founded freedom post-independence was challenged through the setting up of the authority, which in turn took a while to become accepted by Maltese society. Indeed, as we have seen, the critical urban phenomena currently being experienced on the ground are partly a legacy of the laissez-faire attitude that characterized the post-independent period until the setting up of the planning authority, and partly the result of a number of critical decisions taken post-1992. It is clear, therefore, that we need a clear vision established at a national scale which may direct a streamlined and more quality-driven policy framework that gives due regard to the urban design and street scale of our urban design, of our urban settlements. The strategic plan for the environment and development, which is set to replace the structure plan, is now long due, and any policy revisions currently being undertaken need to be considered alongside one another, away from the rhetoric and having clear, achievable targets. In order to do this effectively, however, we need to reevaluate our broader attitudes towards planning, construction, the environment, and one another. This is easier said than done, of course, but not impossible if there is a concerted effort towards a participatory, bottom-up approach towards planning. In the July 1969 special issue of the Architecture Review, entitled Malta, Past, Present, Future, Quentin Hughes, at the time Dean of the Faculty of Architecture and Civil Engineering at the University of Malta, wrote, "The survey is concerned with ways in which Malta can be preserved, because what it has now is its greatest value and quite unrepeatable. The unthinkable alternative is that Malta should choose to neglect her heritage and join the development rat race. Yet she is already trying to do this. If Malta accepts laissez-faire development, the whole island will be obliterated by buildings. And this will take very little time. It will happen unless the planners, architects, and the legislators take action very soon. Malta could lead Europe into a new era of environmental and cultural re-evaluation, or it could become, through a laissez-faire attitude, just another blighted area of exploitation." 44 years later, I'll leave it up to you to decide which path we appear to have chosen. Thank you.
The speaker has very kindly accepted to field any questions that may come from the audience. Anybody wants to ask a question? Yes, Teresa?
You've given an excellent exposé of the history of attitudes towards urbanization of Malta. I wonder, has any relation been found between the history of picturing landscape in Malta, the role of artists in depicting our landscape, and particularly the urban streetscape up to the present day? Is there any relationship with present day attitudes towards the landscape as we know it today?
Well, if there is a relationship, indeed there is, yes. The irregularity of the streetscapes due to the initial settlements, formalized then in the time of the British with actual standards, still retained a certain degree of aesthetic significance within our streetscapes. Obviously, even in between, through the rules of the Ufficio delle Case, but that was more Valletta-oriented. The second time, lucky. I think yes, it is part of the same. It is part of the same issue. The lack of an appreciation of such landscapes is reflected both in aesthetic terms and in our attitudes towards the planning system and the political system and all that. So I believe that it is all interrelated. I don't think there has ever been a specific study in this regard, as far as I know, obviously, I'm aware, but it is certainly part of the equation.
Certainly landscape painting in Malta has had a particular trajectory. During the night of the time of the night, it was the glorification of the fortified landscape. You get a bit of a romantic spirit coming in with specific historic sites being earmarked by artists like Bellanti, the Chirontes, and so on. But then in recent years, the last few decades, we've had a proliferation of a new romantic landscape, one almost that actually doesn't exist in the present day. It would be interesting if this kind of a study had to be made between attitudes towards picturing the landscape and towards the landscape itself in practice.
Absolutely. I'm sure that parallels could be found in this respect.
First of all, Prophet, for the very, very lovely presentation. I'm doing a PhD as well, so, and it's right up my alley, as they say. And to comment on the lady in front of me, during my field work, I got to talk to a number of artists, by pure coincidence, actually. A number of them actually told me that, you know, they've seen the changes happening in our urban landscape, and they're usually the first people in Malta, at least, who would start noticing the subtle changes, because they would go after a few, maybe years or even months sometimes, to maybe touch up some painting of theirs, and they suddenly see a new block of flats. Oh, that's not my painting. And they see the changes, and some of them, of course, make more of an artistic impression of the landscape, whilst others make an actual, I know one artist who actually has done the same landscape over and over again over the years and shown the differences that have happened, and he's very, very angry about how the Maltese people and the Maltese government and the policies surrounding it, as you have very well explained, have literally destroyed a number of beautiful places in Malta. What I was going to comment before the lady in front of me commented about art was that it was a very bold lecture. The fact that you very succinctly criticized both governments and policies that there are within our system in Malta and in vis-a-vis the EU as well. I think that's something that we need to see more in our research and also in the way we actually bring out what's happening in Malta. Because if we do not do that, we're actually losing something that is very precious. Many of us go abroad, and just like myself, I come back, I go there, and I go, what is more beautiful than Malta? Why do we go abroad, and we go, oh, what a beautiful place. And then we come back to Malta, and we go, hey, but isn't this as beautiful as that place? And at the same time, we come back, and a few months later, or a few years later, and we see that we are actually ruining our own socio-physical environment. And we researchers still need to try and understand why we Maltese are actually allowing it to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. And one aspect which I really think is critical in our system is the fact that policies have never been actually tested. They haven't been tested in 3D. They haven't been tested in design terms. And therefore, the landscape hasn't been envisioned, unfortunately. And the result of this is that you end up with plans in a very two-dimensional fashion, and say an urban conservation area is delineated because of the relevance of the urban conservation area, but outside of the urban conservation area, then it's fine. In fact, we appear to have somewhat a two-tier policy structure. So we have the urban conservation areas, which are protected. We have outside development zones, which to a large extent are protected, and the in-between is fine. The in-between can be changed, in-between can be increased in the height relaxation, as if just beyond the UCA, an additional five-story building wouldn't actually be affecting that UCA, because those three floors of blank walls are going to be seen from the UCA. Even worse, the edges, you see many edges of urban settlements. I've done an analysis of urban settlements that are very different from one another internally. But externally, today, they look all the same. So you can't tell the internal workings of these settlements because of this big mass that is at our edges. And therefore, if we don't understand this, if we don't understand that the policies have design implications and we don't do this two-way relationship, then we are just going to be looking at planning simplistically as being, you know, a two-dimensional exercise where a line is defined, and as long as within that line we're fine, then it doesn't make a difference, but it does.
As a planner, you are a planner, I'm not. But the fact that you are a planner and you actually mentioned a bottom-up approach where stakeholder involvement is really needed, and Astrid next to me here can attest to the fact that we've been trying to get social impact assessments more and more off the ground with the stakeholder participation, is very important, because most of the time it doesn't happen. But the problem then becomes that the fact that we have a patron-client relationship in most cases. So you end up with trying to find a balance between this relationship, which is the patron-client relationship that has been going on for centuries, and the fact that we need to have a more bottom-up approach. And that is the balance that we need to reach, basically.
If I could, mine is not a question. Maybe I could just add to what Peritza Meade told us in such an erudite and interesting talk. You mentioned streetscapes. In fact, there is an obligation to submit streetscape plans in order to show how new developments in UCA affect the streetscape. Unfortunately, in most cases where we see UCA applications, this regulation is neither observed nor enforced nor required. And it's for that reason that we currently are pressing probably for photo montages. Exactly as you said, because these things cannot be reduced to flat lines. They need to be seen in 3D. The committees and boards need to understand the damage that is potentially to be inflicted. Now, one thing you mentioned, blank party walls. One thing that was very evident in your photos is the iniquitous regulation that a plot which straddles two streets can rise to the height, the full height of the higher street, which means that we have these 12 floor blocks in five floor areas, like Shamshiya. You showed a terrible party wall here at Spinola. So that's another thing that has really ruined our landscapes. And you also mentioned that the FAR regulations ran more or less between 2000 and 2006. In fact, from, say, 2008, they were taken to be discreetly set aside. We are now seeing the FAR regulations being revived in the latest round of policy revamps, and also, of course, the 4- and 5-star hotels, which are to be given an unlimited height limitation, which has great implications for every other sector, because, of course, other sectors are not going to be slow in jumping on the bandwagon, as they're already trying to do. Thank you.
Yes, one thing that, two things. Firstly, on the urban conservation areas, you're right, it's very inconsistent. I can vouch for that from first-hand experience. Some officers request it, some officers don't. And when they do request it, they request that you submit the neighboring buildings, so an elevation of the two neighboring properties. They don't even request the photo montages. I think that we should, yes, definitely move in that direction. I think that we should also start considering the opportunity for architects to submit design statements. This is done everywhere around us. And a design statement helps you justify your design. It will help you even try to explain policy deviation if you want to deviate from the policy. No, but we need to shift the onus of responsibility. Someone has to take responsibility for design quality. And I think the architectural profession, myself being one of them, needs to do that. We need to take it on board ourselves. We need to drive quality. With regards to the policy revisions, yes, the FAR and the hotels and other policies are being revised. What worries me sometimes is that such policy revisions are happening when the local plans are also being revised. And at some point we're going to end up with a situation where the local plans need to direct these more specific policies like the FAR and so on and so forth. And therefore, we really need to ensure that there is a coordination. And we need to be careful about that.
Yes, the gentleman there.
Can I put comments instead of a question? Yes. Just two observations. One of them did not arise from your lecture. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you for the very interesting and informative presentation. Yeah, I'd like to mention that what was the impact of planning interventions on the traditional towns, villages of Malta. In my opinion, this impact has hardly been observed by students or by researchers. And what I have to say is this, that the traditional shape of a Maltese village was radial, like an octopus. So you had the village hall with the church and the square, and then the roads radiated outwards towards the countryside. So one road would be called Valletta Road, the other road would be called after the neighboring village, etc. This morphology, this octopus-like shape, had the advantage that there was a very pleasant and gradual transition from town to country, between the urban ambience and the rural ambience. So the further out you moved from the village core, you would start getting glimpses of the countryside and spaces between the buildings. When the planners entered the scene, and I'm not pointing fingers at anyone because it's normal for entities or people to plan once they're established, the planners got hold of a pencil, drew a big circle or oval shape around the particular village and said, this is the ring road, the bypass, so development cannot continue beyond this. It didn't really happen that way, because if you look at some of the towns, you'll see that development has really encroached outside this boundary. I consider it as a negative development. But by far the most negative development Malta has experienced recently, and you referred to it in your presentation when you wrote three floors plus penthouse, right? This was the second building height relaxation that happened in Malta in the past 20 years. The first building height relaxation was carried out in the late 90s, I believe, under the then Labour government, politics support, I want to be political. But the first relaxation height established that if there was a two-story building, you could build a third floor, an extra story, a second floor, provided that any basement was not higher than 1 meter above the ground. This was the first hotel. It hardly caused a ripple in development because it was hardly worth it to drop a block of two floors plus underlying basement simply to add another floor. So the impact was minimal. But about 8 years ago, or maybe seven, there was the second height relaxation policy, which means that if you have three floors, you're allowed to build a penthouse. So suddenly, if you have a two-story building, even with a basement, it's worth dropping it now because now you can have four residents. This development, in my opinion, inflicted more damage on our urban environment than enemy bombs in the last world war. Suddenly the whole country became a building site. There was nowhere else to go. Today is the house next to you, tomorrow is the house across the street, and you're subjected to a few months of dust and noise. And this is one of the causes of the huge oversupply of apartments in Malta today, what I call an irreversible cemetery. Thank you.
I would also add that the three floors plus penthouse were indeed a major issue. When the three floors and penthouse had also the possibility of a semi-basement, I think that those tweets went, you know, a step further negatively, because in my view, and my students will know this because I hamper on it every time, the semi-basement broke the horizontal line, the line along the buildings. If, say, the height relaxation policy was implemented without semi-basements, and allowing, say, an additional stepped floor after the second floor, so that at least you could retain the two floors, so even when you had the terraced houses, the two-floor terraced houses, at least there was a certain rhythm, it would have already made somewhat of a difference in my view. But certainly I believe that the semi-basement, which is anyway an inhabitable space, I mean, you know, people, why would someone want to live in a semi-basement? Though I can imagine that people would, and they did, and they bought them. They were the first to leave, the first to be purchased, because they were cheaper, and so you get a good location, but you know, cheaper property because it's a semi-basement. And therefore, the market fueled the policy even more, in my view.
Hello, Amber Wismeyer from Comrades Alperiti. First of all, thank you very much for a very interesting lecture. You mentioned briefly the split, the upcoming split between planning and environment. Do you see this as a positive move? And what, in your opinion, having studied the historical development of urban planning in Malta, is the greatest lesson that we can take from the past and apply in this move?
Okay. I think there's really and truly there's two sides to that argument. Okay? The first side of the argument is that if they are separate and independent of one another, then you have less chance of interests mingling together. So that would be a positive aspect. The negative aspect is that, in truth, planning is what it is, and you know because you studied it with me, is what it is because it's comprehensive. No? It includes everything. It includes the social, yeah, it includes the economical, it includes the environmental, the cultural, the political. And therefore, you need to look at everything holistically. So I can understand that from that point of view, in principle, NEPA would have worked because of this comprehensive thinking. So my reply to it is that I don't know, because there are both sides of the argument, and both are pretty legitimate arguments. Okay. With regard to the lessons from the past to the future, well, I think as we were discussing before, we need to move towards a bottom-up approach. We have been, obviously, exercising planning in a top-down fashion. It's always been like that, historically, and so on and so forth. We need to change that. We need to be more inclusive. Okay? I don't think that because of the scale of our country, we should be considering planning at a local council level. I also think we're not maybe mature enough in that respect. But certainly, I think that we need to be more active and work with local councils in formulating plans and formulating briefs, in having it mandatory for certain projects to actually be part of a community participatory planning workshop, for instance. So I think that certainly one of the biggest lessons that I would take is that we need to really rethink the way that we have done planning in the past years. Some people have said that we should abandon our discretionary planning system and we should go for a regulatory one. In fact, I believe the Chamber of Planners at one point said we should adopt the Dutch model, you know, the Dutch planning system. Why? Because the Dutch are great. They're doing fantastic architecture. They have. In reality, I studied the Dutch planning system for quite a while. And although they have a regulatory planning system, they actually exercise discretion on a daily basis. Of course, it is informal, it is not formalized, but there you have municipalities, which are the main actors, and they negotiate with developers and often change the plans in order to suit those requirements. So the reality is that although we try to, you know, kill our discretionary planning system because of all these issues that have, in reality, if you have to look around you, the rest of Europe, which is regulatory, are actually becoming discretionary in nature. Why? They are putting in informal discretionary practices. Many regulatory planning systems have implemented design reviews, which is a discretionary system. Many of them have gone for urban design codes, rather than basing on the zoning plans, the traditional zoning plans. So they really have understood that their regulatory systems do not work in the current scenario, especially in the current very volatile scenario, right, where you have big economic instability, and therefore you need a planning system that is flexible enough to respond. And to be fair, in theory, our planning system is discretionary and should allow for such flexibility. And therefore, I think we should celebrate our discretionary system. I think we should work on it. I don't think we should abandon it. So I think that is an important lesson, understanding how the discretionary system evolved. Of course, there was a big British influence, so it is understandable that one would have adopted the UK's model for discretionary planning. But I think that we need to supplement this. And for instance, I believe strongly in an independent design review panel in order to really focus on design and design quality. So it's about supplementing, I think, what we have.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled Urban Planning in Malta. This talk was delivered by Dr. Antoine Zamit.